This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from Lexington, Kentucky. And I would like to thank everyone for listening to us tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you checking out the website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance for riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you're able to help, please visit the website www.pdjf.org. Now, I'm very excited for the opportunity to spend an hour with our guest this evening. Get ready for this introduction. He's won the Sovereign Award for Outstanding Jockey twice. He won the Eclipse Award in 1976. He was a recipient of the prestigious George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award along with the Avelino Gomez Memorial Award. He was decorated with the Order of Canada, the highest accomplishment a Canadian citizen can earn. He's a member of the Canadian Hall of Fame and the National Museum of Racing Hall of Fame. That's just barely scratching the surface with 6,450 wins, over $88 million in earnings. It is an honor to introduce to you Sandy Hawley. Sandy, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Christina. You did your homework.
I did, Sandy. Let me tell you, it was a lot of research. My gosh, all of your accomplishments, it's incredible. I think my printer ran out of ink, actually.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you very much, Christina.
How was your holiday weekend, Sandy?
It was good. You know, in Canada here, we have our Thanksgiving in October.
Oh, really?
And you have your Thanksgiving in November. And I remember I lived in California for 10 years, so of course I celebrated Thanksgiving twice.
Well, there you go. There you go. Although when you're riding, I guess you can't eat too much turkey. But
yeah. You know what? Honestly, Christina, when I was a jockey, I never had a weight problem.
Really?
I was one of the very lucky ones because I'd say at least 60% of the jockeys, as you know, a lot of them have to go in the sweat box before the day of racing. And, you know, I can't imagine going in the sweat box and then having to go out to ride 7 or 8 horses in one day. It's unbelievable.
And it brings back bad memories when you talk about the hot box, Sandy. Yeah, I didn't like that part too much. No, but you're very fortunate in that. How tall are you, Sandy?
I'm 5'2".
Okay.
And as I mentioned, I never had a weight problem. And every once in a while, I go in the hot box or sweat box, and I'd have a fudgicle in my hand and go, it's way too hot in here. I have to get out of here.
Oh, I bet they loved you in there, didn't they?
I was going to say, I didn't have very many friends when I did that.
No, probably not. Probably not. But, Sandy, were you always, I suppose you were always small as a kid, and did you always have the idea that you wanted to ride?
You know what? As you mentioned, I was small when I was a kid, and you know, I think we're both in the same boat that I really enjoyed doing all kinds of sports. I played hockey, being from Canada. I played baseball. I played lacrosse. I played all the sports, and I really didn't think about my size. And it's funny that you mentioned that because I remember my uncle Ed Keach, he used to take videos. He was a video buff back then. And sometimes he put it on the screen, and he'd show the old videos. And sometimes he took videos of me playing hockey or me playing baseball. And when I looked at those videos where I look back now, I go, holy mackerel, was I ever small? I was like twice as small as everybody else. But, you know, it really didn't stop me. I played all different sports and never thought about my size until my Uncle Webb Bride, God rest his soul, he mentioned to me, he said, Sandy, what are you going to do when you get out of school? And, of course, I was only 16 at the time, growing up in Oshawa, Ontario, Canada. Didn't know what I was going to do. And he said, well, you should think about becoming a jockey. You're the right size. And that really sparked my interest about, you know, pursuing becoming a jockey. And Mr. E.P. Taylor, who owned the Great Northern Dancer, had a farm in Oshawa. So we went to his farm and didn't see Mr. Taylor, of course, but we met a trainer by the name of Duke Campbell. Mm. When I say we, I mean my uncle took me to the National Stud Farm in Oshawa, and Mr. Campbell ended up being like my second father, took me under his wing. I had no horse racing background whatsoever. So, of course, as you know, Christina, I had to get to know the horses, so I groomed horses for a year, then I exercised horses for a year before I got to ride my first race back in 1968.
Wow. Duke Campbell.
Duke Campbell. He was so instrumental in the success of my career. He was behind me 110%. And as I mentioned, Christina taught me all the fundamentals about becoming a jockey and working around horses.
Did he ride himself?
He was actually, you know what? It's funny. He was a cowboy from Western Canada, and he always wore a Stetson cowboy hat and the cowboy boots, and he was about 6 feet tall.
Oh, wow.
And to me, he was like 9 feet tall. He was a fantastic horseman. He used to get on the pony every morning and come out while we did the morning workouts, and he was just an amazing man.
Did you find it natural for yourself to work around horses, or did you, I know some people we've had here on the show, you know, they said, they were a little nervous maybe in the beginning if they didn't come from a horse background, but what did you feel like? Was it just natural to you?
Well, you know what, I was a little bit nervous. I, you know, really didn't have any horse racing background whatsoever, excuse me, but I just remember Mr. Campbell, you know, he didn't let me get on horses until I groomed horses for a year. The only time I'd ever been on a horse, actually, Christina, was when I was maybe 8 or 9 years old at a riding stable, maybe a couple of times in my whole life that I ever had an opportunity to ride a horse, and I was scared to death. But, you know, Mr. Campbell brought me along slowly. He actually, sometimes when I was grooming horses for that year, when horses came back after morning workouts, he'd let me ride them bareback to cool them out around the barn. You know how after a horse goes for a workout or after he has a race, of course, you don't put him right in the stall. You walk him for like a half an hour or 45 minutes, sometimes up to an hour it takes them to cool down. Well, he'd let me ride them around the shed, and I'd have to ride them bareback, he said, because that would teach me my balance. So he was a great teacher.
No, bareback is definitely a good way to learn your balance. You don't have anything underneath you, so you got to hang on.
Well, it definitely is. And sometimes they'd be like two-year-olds that I'd be on. And, of course, when they heard a noise, the two-year-olds would try and take off with you, and here I am bareback trying to control them bareback going around the shed roll.
Get tied on, right, Sandy?
Sometimes I ended up going out the end of the shed roll on these two-year-olds. But it taught me pretty quick, that's for sure.
Did you find that because you were an athlete as a kid, did you find that when you started, you know, you started out bareback, but then when you actually got a leg up in the saddle, did you find that was easier because you were an athlete? It just came pretty easy to you?
You know what? I think it helped that I played all kinds of sports, and you know, you have a very good point that I was in really, really good shape because the last year I went to school, I was on the wrestling team. And 98-pound weight class.
Wow.
And I ended up, I only wrestled for 1 year, and I ended up going to the All-Ontarios and finished second in the All-Ontarios. So I was in pretty good shape. I was a pretty good athlete. And I think that helped me a ton when I started learning to ride horses because, of course, you do need the strength. You have to, as you know, try and outsmart them as well. You can't use brute strength. But I think being an athlete, you have a very, very good point that I think that really helped me earlier in my career.
And Sandy, did you find that as your riding progressed and you started going to the track and breezing horses, did you find that you had that satisfying feeling that you found what you really wanted to do?
You know what? Honest to goodness, I remember even when I was grooming horses, I just loved being in the outdoors. I loved being around the horses. I love animals in general. And just to be able to be outdoors, and, you know, of course, as you remember, too, we really had to work hard to work our way up to become a jockey. You don't just go to the racetrack and all of a sudden start getting on horses and the next week you're a jockey.
No.
You really have to pay your dues. But I knew right from the very beginning, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to pursue. You know, I remember watching the great Avelino Gomez up here. As you mentioned, I received the Avelino Gomez Award, and that's one of my most cherished possessions because he was my idol when I first started riding.
Really?
But I remember even when I was grooming horses, I used to watch him, and I used to look at the other jockeys. Robin Platts was one of the top jockeys, Brian Swadek and Richard Grubb. And I remember seeing him in the kitchen one morning, and I'm going, holy mackerel, there's Richard Grubb, there's Brian Swadek, and I was just in awe of these riders, and I just thought it'd be so cool to get my name in the program just to be riding with these guys. And, you know, never thinking in a million years that things would work out the way they worked out.
It's funny how life works, isn't it, Sandy? But how was it for you when you did take out your license and you started riding and you're in the starting gate? I remember, Sandy, my first race, I had Calvin Burrell to my inside, Julian Leperu to my outside, and I was just, wow, this is awesome. And how was it for you when you took out your license and started riding and being surrounded by these riders you looked up to?
I remember my first race. It was on the turf, and I remember I was in the starting gate, and I remember one of the jockeys beside me looked over and said, Jock, I think you should probably pull your goggles down. So that was a very good tip.
Very good.
So I pulled my goggles down, and I think I finished fifth that day. But, oh, you talk about nerve-wracking. And you know what? Honest to goodness, I used to get on like 10 horses a morning for Mr. Campbell. And so I was in pretty good shape when it came to fitness-wise. But I'll tell you, when I rode that first race and I got off that horse, my knees almost buckled. My legs were shaky. And I think it's, you know, the stress and it's just a different physical fitness riding in the afternoon than riding in the mornings.
That's absolutely correct. And I was the same exact way, Sandy. I think it's the adrenaline and you're excited and it's happening and it goes by so fast and you just can't believe it. And you get off the horse and, yeah, it's just overwhelming in a way. And how about those riders you mentioned, did any of those great accomplished jockeys, did they take you under their wing when you first started out and teach us show you the ropes in the room?
You know what? They really did. They really helped me out. I remember they used to holler at me a lot in races because, you know, when you're green, you probably drop in when you shouldn't be dropping in and you drift out when you shouldn't be drifting out and going for a hole that really isn't there. And I remember Hugo Ditfa and Avelino Gomez, they used to holler at me all the time, Sandy, where are you going? What are you doing this for? Why are you doing that? But I'll never forget Brian Swadek gave me probably the best tip I ever received. Well, a couple of tips he gave me. And unfortunately, Brian Swadek passed away from brain cancer last year. Mm. Just a wonderful, wonderful guy and a great jockey as well. He was leading rider of Canada one year. But he gave me a tip. He said, Sandy, he said, when you're coming to a turn, he said, either be in the hole or get out. He said, because, you know, you can't make a move when you're going into a turn because horses change leads and they change paths. And that was a fantastic tip that he gave me, and that helped me a lot early in my career. He also told me, he said, Sandy, when you're out there, just pretend like you're as good as anybody else. Yeah. Don't feel like you're intimidated by other jockeys of who they are. Just, if you have the horse, you can get the job done. And that was a fantastic tip for me that lasted with me my whole career.
Oh, very, very good advice. Very good advice, Sandy. Brian Swadek. That's why get in or get out. I remember being told that as well. That's not a good spot you want to be in going into the turn.
That's not a good spot.
No.
It's like, okay, if you're not up in there, if you're only half length in there, you better get out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You better get out. It's not going to be good. Not going to be good. And, Sandy,
no.
So you started out riding, and you had an incredible year as an apprentice, a full season as an apprentice. And tell us how that transpired.
Well, I remember my first year was 1968, and I only rode 30 horses because Mr. Campbell didn't want my full apprenticeship to start. As you know, when you first start out, you have a 10-pound weight allowance as an apprentice jockey. he didn't want my my 5-pound weight allowance to kick in until the next year. So I won 4 races that year, and then he stopped me because he didn't want me to win my 5th race, because then your apprenticeship starts. You have your apprenticeship for a whole year, or I think it's 40 wins, whichever comes last. Anyways, he took me off all my mounts after I won my 4th race in 68. 1969 was my first full year, and the agent that I started with that year was an agent by the name of Colin Wick. And you know what, Christina, when I look back now, Mr. Campbell was so instrumental in the success of my career. But another gentleman that was just as instrumental was an agent by the name of Colin Wick. He ended up traveling with me all over the country, in Canada, United States. And in my estimation now, he actually had Brian Swadock when Brian Swadock was a leading rider of Canada.
Really?
And he also had a jockey called Jim Fitzsimmons years and years ago, who was also the leading rider of Canada. So he was a great agent in his own right. When he took me in 1969, I didn't realize the type of agent I was getting. He was, in my estimation now, the best agent ever in Canada. And if you come to Canada and you ask anybody who is the best agent ever in Canada, they'll say Colin Wick. And he, not only in Canada, but I think he was one of the best in North America. He was just a fantastic agent. And so having Duke Campbell behind me, having Colin Wick behind me, they were two guys that were very instrumental in me getting started in 1969.
Why was that? What made Colin Wick such a good agent?
You know what? He had a very good rapport with all the owners and trainers. He was very, very well liked. A lot of times after the races, he would go back to the backstretch. Of course, he liked to have his drinks, his toddies, and liked to have a beer or a scotch and soda once in a while. And not once in a while, he probably drank a lot. But he was just a very, very character guy. He knew the condition book inside out. He knew where horses belonged. And like I say, sometimes when an agent is out there in the mornings, sometimes a trainer is busy and they don't want to see the agent. They don't want to bother with him at that point. But Colin Wick was the type of agent, everybody loved having him under a shed roll. He always had a joke, and he was always a funny guy, just a real fun guy to be around. I think that was one of his top attributes, and also he just knew the condition book inside out. He did his homework. He liked to go out and have a few drinks, and a lot of times he would do his work after the races were over. He would go back to the barns. If he saw a horse finish second or third or got in trouble in a race, he'd go back to that barn and try and get on that horse. Mm. And a lot of times he wouldn't leave until he got the call.
Put me on that horse or I'm sticking around. That's
exactly.
Awesome.
I'm going to have another drink with you, and I'm not going to leave until you put me on that horse.
Well, there you go. That's the way to get it done. That's the way to get it done. And Sandy, you said he took you everywhere. You said so you didn't just ride in Canada your first full year with the apprentice. You shipped pretty much everywhere. And what kind of opportunities led you to different racetracks?
Well, I just remember riding in Canada in the summertime. And, of course, we don't have racing here in the winter. We only have an eight-month season. So for the other 4 months, I would go with Colin Wick, and we would go somewhere in the United States and ride for the winter. I remember the very first winter I went to Florida. And, of course, I was there as an apprentice, and I was riding with the great jockeys, Angel Cordero, Jacinto Vasquez, George Velasquez. You know, all those great jockeys were there, and even Eddie Belmonte way back when. And it was such an honor and a pleasure to be able to ride with those guys in Florida. But I went with a trainer by the name of, well, Mr. Campbell took a few horses there, but Frank Merrill, who used to be one of the top trainers in Florida at the time. He was a Canadian, but he used to go to Florida every winter, and he was like first or second leading trainer. Then I started riding for a trainer by the name of Arnold Winnick back then in Florida, and things just really took off for me in Florida as well, which, you know, I never expected in a million years.
How was it going from Canada to Florida? Was there any difference in the way the riders rode? Was it tighter, tougher? How was that for you?
Well, the weather was a lot warmer, I know that.
Well, that's true.
It was beautiful going down to Florida for the winter. The riders, the unbelievable riders, like I mentioned some of the names, Angel Cordero, Braulio Baeza, Cinto Vasquez, George Velasquez, the best jockeys in the world at that time went to Florida. Of course, the California riders didn't have to go to Florida for the winter because they're in California, but just to be able to ride with those top riders, and they're really tough to ride against. I'll tell you what, you better have a good horse if you're going to beat one of those guys.
Well, and that has to teach you a lot, too. I was always told, you know, it's much better to learn to ride on a good horse. And I have to think the same is true for riding among good jockeys. You don't want to ride around bad jockeys. You're going to pick up bad habits. So to ride amongst the best, that had to be an incredible learning experience, too.
Well, you know what? It really was. We had a great jockey colony at Woodbine. Of course, as I mentioned, Avelino Gomez was one of the best jockeys in the history of horse racing, not only in Canada, but North America as well. He used to go to Florida for the winters as well. Excuse me, I'm just kind of getting over a cold.
Oh, no.
Excuse me for that.
No, you're good.
But Avelino was amazing, and I remember riding with him and learning so many things off of him. And I kind of copied his style, where he used to, you probably know the terminology, kidney bouncing. He used to kidney bounce on a horse a lot. So I got to the point where I did that myself, and I felt that it worked for me. But, you know, riding in Florida was fantastic, but I had an opportunity to go to California a few years later and ride with the great Bill Shoemaker. And I remember Bill Shoemaker, who, in my estimation, I think was the greatest jockey of all time. He never kidney bounced. He was a lot smaller than me. He was just a tiny jockey. But he just had the hands. And he sat so still on a horse. So I kind of changed my style. So as you mentioned, going to different racetracks, riding with great jockeys, you kind of change your style. And I think it does make you a better jockey for sure.
It's funny you mentioned Bill Shoemaker, Sandy, because I would like you to tell our audience about an incredible record you broke in 1973.
Yeah, that was it was quite exciting. I remember my agent, Colin Wick, of course, as I mentioned earlier on. We were having a New Year's drink in Laurel, Maryland. And we had a couple of years back-to-back where we'd had some really good years. And Colin Wick said to me, you know what, we've had a couple of years back-to-back. We were having a New Year's drink, so I'd had a couple of beers, and he said, how about next year we try and go for 500 wins? Well, I thought he was crazy. And I said, yeah, let's go for it. I'm not thinking about the work involved. And the next day I won two races at Laurel, and he came up to me after the races, and he said, Sandy, we only have 482 to go, or no, 498 to go.
Yeah.
And so he said, we only have 498 to go. So he remembered what he had said the night before, and we did. He actually told the media here in Canada that we're going to try and win 500 races, and Bill Shoemaker had the record back then. He had, I think it was 486 wins. So, you know, going for Mr. Shoemaker's record and finally reaching that goal in Laurel, Maryland, you know, during the winter, we ended up winning 515 races that year, and to be able to break Mr. Shoemaker's record, it was quite a thrill.
That is an incredible accomplishment, and I'm sure that record still holds. Is that true?
No, it doesn't. It's been broke about three times now.
Oh.
In fact, my buddy, Chris McCarron, who when I moved to California, I was there a little bit before Chris, but when Chris moved to California, we had the same valet, and we ended up becoming best friends. He tells a story about when I broke that record in Laurel, Maryland. It was at... I think it was at Bowie Racetrack. He said he was, it may have been Laurel, but he said he was jumping up and down. Yeah, I think it was Laurel Racetrack, actually. He said he was jumping up and down trying to get in the picture, and the son of a gun the next year broke my record. He won, I think, 548 races, I think, the next year.
Ah, Chris, my gosh. Funny.
Chris McCarron, my best friend, and the son of a gun had to go and break my record in 1 year.
Well, funny story about Chris. We're gonna show the replay of your Living Legends race at Santa Anita in 2008 And funny story, I was actually attending Chris McCarron's jockey school in 2008 when he shipped over there. And he came back.
What a great teacher.
Oh, he was incredible. He's awesome. He's such an amazing person. And he came back, Sandy, and he was so mad that you beat him. Let me tell you what.
Well, I was definitely on the best horse, Christina. If you're going to do that replay, you're going to see how far the horse won by. I wish I had could have beat Chris by a head or something like that. That would have been even better. But once you see the replay, you'll see that I was definitely on the best horse.
Well, Sandy, a win's a win. That's all that counts. That is.
I didn't fall off.
No, which is an amazing story, and we'll get to that as we go along. But everything you've been through, and you retired, and you come back, and you look like you hadn't missed a day, Sandy. It's an awesome thing. It's an awesome thing.
I'll tell you, it was very nerve-wracking. And I remember Pat Day and I were staying at the same hotel, and he was kind of waiting for a cab or something. I said, Pat, I said, I'm going to the racetrack to Santa Anita. I'll give you a ride. So he said, oh, thank you, Sandy. So he got in the front seat with me, and we're driving to Santa Anita. And he said, Sandy, I don't know about you, but I'm a little bit anxious about today. I thought to myself, holy cow, Pat Day's anxious. He was known as Patient Pat and Payday and all that. And I'm thinking, holy cow, I'm a little anxious myself, Pat.
Well, none of you looked it, and it sure didn't show. And how was that for you? Let's talk about that before we hear that here in just a minute. How was it for you to come back after, 10 years?
Yeah, I hadn't ridden for 10 years. I hadn't been out of the starting gate for 10 years. I didn't come out of the starting gate until that day. Mm-hmm. I went across the road because I live here in Oshawa, Ontario, and across the road, Winfield Farms was still running. And so they had some of their horses that they were still training. A lot of them were babies. So I actually called them up and asked them if they would mind if it was just like almost walking distance from my house to go over and get on a few horses. And they said, oh, yeah, come on out anytime. So I went out and I got on a couple of days over at Winfield Farms and kind of got back in shape, went to the gym a lot. And I weighed about 121 when I got the phone call, and I had a month to get ready. And when I went down, I think I weighed 108. So I was in pretty good shape when I went back down.
108 after a month. Wow. That is awesome. And when they asked you, Sandy, did you have any hesitation on doing that?
You know what? Not really, because when Lafitte Pincai, it was actually Lafitte Pincai that called me from California. It was such an honor. He said, we're trying to get this Legends race put together, Hall of Fame jockeys. And I just thought, wow, I said, Lafitte, I really, really appreciate you calling me and asking me having me be part of this. And he said, well, your name came up, and we just wanted to see if you'd be interested. And I said, Lafitte, if you get the race put together, if you get it going, I said, definitely count me in. But Christina, I remember hanging up the phone. I go, holy crap, what did I just do?
Well, Sandy,
let's
hear that replay now. We'll continue our visit with jockey Sandy Hawley after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. Paco Lopez made the most out of his seven mounts as he won the Grade 3 Comley aboard Verve's Tale and the Grade 2 Demoiselle aboard Miss Sky Warrior. Lopez finished the week with three wins, 1 second, and 2 third-place finishes. Javier Castellano also won 2 stakes races at Aqueduct, highlighted by the Grade 1 Cigar Mile aboard Connect. Castellano finished the week in the money on 54% of his mounts with 6 wins, 8 seconds, and 6 third-place finishes. Florent Giroux had a great weekend in New Mexico and Kentucky as he won the Zeopark Oaks aboard Family Tree and the Grade 1 Clark aboard Gunrunner. Giroux finished the week with 5 wins and 3 second-place finishes. Finally, the Shuffle Bean Coffee Jockey of the Week, Brian Hernandez Jr., had a great closing weekend at Churchill Downs as he won 4 stakes races. On Thursday, Hernandez won the Grade 3 River City aboard Thatcher Street and followed that up with 2 stakes wins on Friday, highlighted by the Grade 2 Miss Revere aboard Linda. Hernandez would then take the Grade 2 Kentucky Jockey Club aboard McCracken and earn 10 points towards qualifying for the Derby. Hernandez finished the week with 6 wins, 2 seconds, and 7 third-place finishes. John Parada's newest book, Half a Chance, is available now at JockeyTalk360.com. Half a Chance is the story of a down-on-his-luck jockey agent who finds himself entangled in a web of deceit and larceny. Visit JockeyTalk360.com for more information and to order. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Jerry Bailey's in with a shot. Dee Dee's Legacy. Jerry Bailey just waiting for room. Now Julie Crone moving into contention with Major Smoke. Julie Crone on the grandstand side. Gary Stevens and Scandalous fifth. Homeward Bound and Sandy Hawley in front. And it's Sandy Hawley and Tribal Chief opening up on them with a 16th to go. And Sandy Hawley and Tribal Chief romping home. 59 years old. Sandy Hawley still got it. Jerry Bailey and Dee Dee's Legacy was second. Gary Stevens and Scandalous third. And Pat Day finished fourth on Swift to Mount.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm Christina McManigal, and I'm joined tonight by jockey Sandy Hawley, 59 years old, and he's still got it. Sandy, how did you feel after winning that race?
Tired. I'm glad it was over.
Yes. All done. Was it similar to the first race you ever rode? We were talking about that earlier.
You know what? My knees weren't quite as wobbly, but it's almost like you're learning all over again. And I just remember we had a meeting before the race, and all the riders were all saying the same thing: is, you know what? Let's everybody get around safe. Don't make any stupid moves or whatever, and just to go out there and have a good time, and just everybody make it back safe and sound, which ended up working out really, really well.
Absolutely, for you especially. And it's funny because prior to that race, you had 6,449 wins, and you were able to make that an even number. Was that a good feeling?
That was a thing where you like to end on an even number, and I just thought after being retired for 10 years, I thought, well, I'm going to be on that odd number the rest of my life. And I'm very happy with the way things went throughout my career. I was very lucky as well. But to reach that 6,450 was pretty cool. Like I say, I never thought I'd end up on that even number, which I was hoping my last race I could do. But I ended up finishing third in my last race. But you know what? One of my buddies, Al Crost, I have to give him some credit, because that next year when Christmas came along, I got a Christmas gift from him. And it was personalized license plates. And it has on it 6,450 wins.
Really?
And I have it right to this day.
And so you still drive around with those license plates?
Yeah, sometimes I have people say, What's that license plate mean? So it's quite an honor to be able to say that's how many wins I ended up with in my career.
Oh, that's an incredible feat. So, folks, if any of you drive around Oshawa, Ontario, you see the license plate, honk and wave and say hi to Sandy.
Cool.
Yeah, that is just looking back. And, of course, you've reached, you know, your 5,000th win, your 6,000th win, and reaching those kind of milestones. Did you ever have any idea you would get to that point?
Not in a million years. Like I say, I remember starting to ride with Avelino Gomez and Richard Grubb, Brian Swadek, and all I wanted to do is just get my name in the program. And they used to have a list of the top 10 jockeys. And I thought, oh, man, that'd be so cool to be able to be on that list. Once you start riding, then, you know, you start striving for better things and your business starts picking up. And you go, oh, man, one of these days it'd be so cool to be on that list when they had the program as top jockeys, just to be in that top 10. And never thinking in a million years, Christina, it would work out the way it worked out.
Sandy, you've mentioned Avelino Gomez a couple times, and of course you received the Avelino Gomez Memorial Award, and he was obviously a good friend of yours, and he also was a very accomplished rider. You both won 4 Queen's Plates, and he was just a very talented rider. But tell us a little bit about his story. He had a very sad story at the end.
Yeah, it was very, very unfortunate. I remember when I was still riding full-time at Woodbine, Greenwood, and Fort Erie here in Ontario, he decided he was going to retire from being a jockey. He became a trainer for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. And things were going okay for him, but I guess he still had that, just had the bug of getting back on a horse and being a jockey again. And he did. He got back in the saddle and was riding again. He was doing well. And unfortunately, I remember I went to California, and I was living there full-time, and I came back to ride in a race called the Canadian Oaks. And I remember coming back to ride in that race, and unfortunately, Avelino Gomez had a spill in that race, and that's when he ended up, unfortunately, passing away. I remember the race. I remember being in behind, and his horse actually broke down in behind, and another jockey plowed into the back of him, unfortunately. And, of course, Avelino got hit from behind by another horse. He had internal bleeding. And I remember actually seeing Avelino in the ambulance, and I said, Avelino, are you okay? And he said, yeah, I think I'm just a little bit bruised up. So he went to the hospital, and his brother was his agent at the time, Mickey Gomez. And Mickey came in after the last race, and I said, Mickey, how's Avelino? And he said, they said he's just a little bit bruised up, but he's going to be off for a while, but he's going to be okay. So I felt good about that. I was at dinner that night, and I was at dinner with the head of the media department at Woodbine, Bruce Walker. And I'll never forget, we were just about to order dessert, and he got a phone call. He went to the phone, he came back, and he said, Avelino died on the operating table. So that was a terrible, terrible experience for me. I remember I was scheduled to go back to California, and his family asked me to be a pallbearer, and I ended up being a pallbearer for the great Avelino Gomez.
Wow, that's incredible. Sandy, did you ever have any fears, I suppose, of getting in the saddle when you hear stories like that and good friends of yours passed away on the track? And, of course, when you ride for very long, you have many injuries, and you've yourself, of course, had very serious injuries. And did you ever have any fears or doubts or worries when you're in the saddle? Did you ever experience that?
Well, you know what, Christina, as a jockey, and you know very well that when you're out there, you know, it's your job. And, you know, of course I thought about the danger every once in a while, but most times I didn't even think about the danger. I always believed in fate. I believed, you know, I could go out in the parking lot and get run over by a car, or I could get in a car accident, or, you know, some other type of accident. And I always believed in fate. And I believe that when it's your time, it's your time. And I think that's what got me through it, is believing in fate.
And that's funny you say that, Sandy. When I was trying to convince my family to be okay with the fact of, you know, my chosen career choice, I always said the same thing. I said, you never know. You just never know. There could be an earthquake and the house could fall on top of me tomorrow. You don't know what could happen, and you might as well do what you want to do, live your dream, and make the most of the time that you're given. And that's a...
You know what, sometimes too, Christina, I know I've been on a horse where he hasn't felt 100% in post-parade, and I take him to the vets. You probably had to do that yourself sometimes, and the vet looks at the horse and scratches the horse. So you get off the horse, you take the tack off, you're waiting for the race to run, so you get a ride back to the jockey's room with the ambulance, and all of a sudden the horses break out of the gate, and jockeys are hollering, and they're bumping, and the thunder and the power that you see coming out of that starting gate. And when I'm sitting on the ground, I go, I do that? It looks a lot scarier from the ground, that's for sure.
Oh, it does. It does. When you're out there, it's different. You're just in the zone, and you're one with the horse, and you love it, you know?
True,
and you have to have
true,
a passion
yeah.
for the sport, obviously, when you do something as dangerous and as hard, and, you know, you have to put a lot of work into it. You have to have that passion. And
what's funny too is sometimes I see races now, and I see pictures of from the past, and you see just the tip of your toe is in the stirrups. I go, how in the heck did I do that? Like, how did I just have my toes in the stirrups like that? And it's just a thing that you get used to. It's your job, and that's where you're brought up, and you're taught how to ride that way. And it's amazing though when I look back and I go, how in the heck? Because I just have my little toes in there like that.
It is incredible to think that our toes are really what's keeping us there in the saddle, and that's about it, really. It's incredible the way the sport is. And Sandy, you yourself, as I mentioned, had some pretty bad spills, and tell us about some of those.
Well, you know what? I was very, very lucky throughout my whole career. Of course, I'm involved with Jockeys and Jeans now, the PDJF as well. And, you know, I feel so blessed that I ended up all in one piece. But I did have a few nasty spills. People say, well, how many spills do you think you had? And when you look back, you think, well, I probably had an average of 2 a year. So I probably fell on my head about 60 times.
Mm.
But there's two times that really kind of stick out in my head. And the one time is I remember I went to ride in a stake race in New Orleans, and I was on a few horses that day, and I remember the second horse that day fell with me on the turf. And I'll never forget when that horse fell with me on the turf. I had come in from California to ride in New Orleans, and the ambulance came and the paramedics came, and they were putting me into the ambulance, and I go, what happened? Like, what happened? And I remember the female paramedic said, oh, you're in a spill. You're riding a horse and you fell. And I go, well, where am I? And she said, you're at the fairgrounds in New Orleans. And honest to goodness, Christina, the last thing I remembered, I was in California.
Wow.
And my dad actually helped me drive down to New Orleans for that race. And the last thing I remember, he was still in Canada. When he got in the back of the ambulance, I said, Dad, what are you doing here? And he said, well, what do you mean, what am I doing here? I helped you drive from California. And so I had a really bad concussion, and I couldn't ride for another 2 months after that.
Really?
So that was one of the instances. But my worst accident of all, believe it or not, was not even in a race. It was actually on a Wednesday night at Woodbine Racetrack. It was about 5 years before I retired. So I've been riding for about 25 years. But I was in post parade, and one of the horses in front of me was acting up and started backing up. And I was with the pony, and I was probably about, you know, but the seven post. And as the horse was backing into us, my filly got really scared. And as you know, they're very fractious. Mm-hmm. And she reared up to get out of the way. Well, it was on a bit of a grade, and she got to the point of no return where she came over backwards. Mm-hmm. And you probably had that happen to you before too, Christina, where the horse goes up and you go one way, the horse goes the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unfortunately, this time I went to the left and the horse came to the left. Mm-hmm. And the horse landed on top of me. And she was about 1,200 pounds.
Mm.
And I'll never forget, it just felt like a chiropractor adjusted every bone in my body at the same time.
Oh, my gosh.
And I ended up with a fractured vertebrae, a broken pelvis, severed urethra, separated shoulder, and broken ribs all in one shot.
That is a lot to deal with, Sandy. That's how long did it take you to recover from all of that?
Well, it took me 8 months, so I missed a whole year of racing in Canada, and I went back to California after 8 months and started getting back in shape to start riding again. But that was probably my worst injury. And it's funny, as you know, we're the only sport in the world that has an ambulance follow you around. And I remember the paramedics coming when I was laying on the ground, and they asked me where it hurt.
Everywhere?
And I said, well, it hurts everywhere but my nose. I said, I think that's the only place it doesn't hurt. But that was my worst injury.
Wow. Do you wake up now, Sandy? I know if it snows or it rains, I'm better than the weatherman. I can tell what's going on according to how my body feels in the morning.
Yeah, true. I've got a few aches and pains, and I've had a few operations for arthritis and stuff like that. But one of the very, very lucky ones, that's for sure.
Well, and Sandy, I'm sure you would agree with me when I say this, that probably your greatest accomplishment is that you beat cancer.
Yeah, that was a tough one, too. That was, I'm trying to think of how much longer I rode after I was diagnosed. I think I rode for another 10 years. I think it was 20 years into my career, and I was diagnosed with malignant melanoma, and that was quite a scary thing. It started with a mole on my back, and they took the mole off. A plastic surgeon took it off and sent it away to be analyzed, and I asked him what it was, if it was dangerous. And he said, well, we have to wait for the biopsy. And I'll never forget, during the period of time I was waiting for the biopsy, I got to ride a horse in Kentucky in the stake race, and I was riding in California at the time. So while I was in Kentucky, I rode the stake race, I was in the shower, and one of the other jockeys in the shower said, Sandy, he said, what's that scar on your back? And I said, oh, it was a black mole, and I had it taken off, and they sent it away to be analyzed. And he said to me, he said, it wasn't malignant melanoma, was it? He actually knew what melanoma was.
No.
I said, no, I said, I'm not sure what it was. They said I have to go back for my biopsy. And he said, well, it's a good thing it wasn't malignant melanoma, because I had a buddy that had that, and he only lasted for 2 months. And, of course, I didn't know what malignant melanoma was at the time. But I went back to California, Christina, and a week later I had to go in for my biopsy. And the plastic surgeon said, I've got bad news. That mole was malignant melanoma, and it was in its fifth level, the worst stage it can go to. You're going to have to go to a surgeon right away. So I'm a big hockey fan. I remember driving home and thinking of what the jockey said in Kentucky and thinking to myself, I'm not going to know who's going to win the Stanley Cup this year.
Oh, my gosh.
It's crazy what goes through your head, but that's one of the things that definitely went through my head.
And so you had the worst stage, fifth stage melanoma, and you were pretty much told, you know, it's very serious, I guess only a couple months. And then correct. What happened? How did you beat it?
Well, I think so many times throughout my career and throughout my life, I've been in the right place at the right time. And I think I was in the right place at the right time again. I went to a surgeon, Dr. Helsper, I'll never forget his name. And he was out of Pasadena, California, and he looked at me. He did all kinds of tests, and he said, yeah, we're going to have to do some serious surgery. So he did a major surgery on my back and took some lymph glands from the side of my neck. And then he said there was only one microscopic trace that it had spread through your body. And unfortunately, I remember going to ride in Chicago for a while, and it was only about 4 months later where it turned up on the other side of my neck, and I had this big lump on the side of my neck, so I knew exactly what that was. It was a melanoma coming back again. So I went back to California, and Dr. Helsper performed another operation, took some lymph glands out, and a little while after that, it went to my lung. So he finally said, I'm going to have to send you to an oncologist, where I started getting vaccine shots, which were experimental. Jeez, this is going back about 26, 27 years ago now. And the shots actually ended up working on me. And, you know, I have to thank the guy up above. I was in the right place at the right time to get these experimental vaccine shots.
So who won the Stanley Cup that year, Sandy?
You know, I remember that year, but I can't remember who in the heck it was now. It was probably like the Edmonton Oilers or someone like that when they had a dynasty back then, or maybe the Islanders when they were a dynasty.
Yeah. And how was it, how did that all affect your riding career? I wouldn't imagine that you would be able to ride while you're going through all this?
You know, honest to goodness, I never really felt sick during the whole period of time. It's, you know, it's a crazy thing to think back and think, well, why in the heck wasn't I sick? You know, I was so close to maybe not even making it. The only time I was really off, Christina, is during the period of times when I had the operation, the major operation I had on my back, the one I had on my neck. Then I had a lobe taken off my lung as well later on. And I really only missed maybe a couple of months during those period of times, you know, off riding. I could continue riding. And even while I was getting my vaccine shots, they hurt like a son of a gun and could hardly raise my arm or kind of limped a little bit when I got the shots in my hips. But I continued riding, and I just have to give praise to the doctors that I had and the guy up above as well. I guess it wasn't my time to join them.
Well, as you said, fate, you know, it's an amazing thing. And what an incredible story that you were able to beat that and all of your other long lists of accomplishments. Sandy, an incredible story. I'm here with jockey Sandy Holly. He's joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Sandy, you've mentioned hockey several times. You played as a kid, and, of course, mm-hmm. you're from Canada, so I might be under the wrong assumption, but I do think that everyone in Canada likes hockey. So you actually had an interesting experience in California, and you worked for the Los Angeles Kings, is that right?
Yeah, that's true. I worked in the penalty box, and the way I ended up with that job is I remember going to ride in California and decided to stay there full time, ended up living there for 10 years. And I just remember when I first went there, I wanted to go to an L.A. Kings game. So I went to an L.A. Kings hockey game, and I became a Kings fan, and I decided to get season's tickets. So I used to go to all the hockey games. You know, we'd ride at Santa Anita, and then I'd have to rush over to the L.A. Forum, which was in Inglewood, to go and see the hockey games. But I just loved it. I enjoyed going to the games as a big hockey fan from Canada. And I got to know a few of the Kings players, which was pretty cool as well. And I remember Bill Morris, who was the boss of the off-ice officials. He ran the clock. And I remember he used to come up to my seats and say hello. And we used to play golf together and used to come to the races. So we became pretty good friends. And one night, Christine came up to my seats and he said, "Sandy, no pun intended, but I'm short a guy to work in a penalty box tonight. Can you come down and work in the box?" I thought, "Holy cow, are you serious?" I said, "What do I have to do?" And he was serious. He said, "Well, all you have to do is write the time the guy goes in, when he gets out, and just let him out at the appropriate time." So I went down that night, and I helped him out, and I loved it. It was where the action was. The players come in, and they're all upset, and they never think they deserved a penalty, and it was pretty cool, and it was a fairly easy job, too, as Bill said. You know, you just have to open the door for the guys and let them out at the appropriate time. So I told Bill, I said, "Bill, I said, I enjoyed myself tonight. Anytime you need me again, count me in." And he said, "Well, I've got a guy retiring next year if you want to do it full-time." Mm-hmm. So I ended up doing it for about 5 years, and it was fantastic. I loved it.
5 years. So you're on the ice. You're literally right there just monitoring.
Well, not totally right on the ice, but you're right at ice surface,
yeah.
Which really, really was really cool. And I got to meet a few of the hockey players, which was fantastic as well. So it was a really neat experience.
Dream job, I'm sure, for a hockey fan like yourself, Sandy. What a cool thing. Not only are you a Hall of Fame jockey, but you also worked for the Los Angeles Kings. That was really cool
and something I'll never forget the rest of my life. And I've got Bill Morris to thank for that. And he's still a good friend, and we still keep in touch.
Wow, that's an awesome story. Awesome story, Sandy. So let's talk more about your riding career. We only have a couple, 10 minutes left, I guess, something like that. This time is flying by. 5 minutes left, I'm sorry. So tell me, Sandy, I was actually telling a friend of mine the other day that I was having you on the show, and he said, "Well, ask him what was his best ride."
My best ride. You know what? I think it was the year that I broke Bill Shoemaker's record.
Yeah.
And I think it was a horse called Charlie Jr. And I remember we were striving to be the first jockey to win 500 races, and that was our goal, to reach number 500. Mr. Shoemaker had the record, and to be able to break his record was awesome. But since our goal was number 500, we ended up winning 515 that year. But my favorite win, and it will be in my mind forever, my favorite mount was a horse called Charlie Jr. when we were in the winner's circle with that 500th win of the year.
Charlie Jr.
Charlie Jr. It was for a trainer by the name of Dick Dottreau, who unfortunately has passed on now. But he was an amazing, amazing trainer in Laurel, Maryland. If you go to Laurel, Maryland and ask anybody if they know who Dickie Dottreau is, they'll definitely say he was one of the greatest trainers of all time in Maryland.
Oh, definitely, definitely a legend. I rode in Maryland, so I'm very familiar.
So you probably know Dick Dottreau.
Yes, I know of
Dick Dottreau.
Of his legend, absolutely. And Charlie Jr., so what makes that race stick out so much in your mind, just other than the fact that that was such a monumental win for you, but how about the actual race itself?
Well, it was for Mr. Dottreau, actually, and, you know, he put me on a lot of winners that year. I remember actually riding at Woodbine and riding at Greenwood as well near the end of the year. And I remember going and riding for Mr. Dottreau on my days off. And he would actually, he was so good to me. He would take other riders off and put me on because he knew I was going for the record. So if it wasn't for him as well, among a number of other trainers that put me on their horses, you know, I never would have reached the 500 win. So, you know, to be able to be in the winner's circle with Mr. Dottreau as well was a great thrill. Charlie Jr. was just a claimer. He was one of the favorites, if not the favorite in the race. I remember he ended up winning by like two or three lengths. And, you know, just to be able to reach the wire, it's like winning a $1 million race. It was awesome.
That's great, Sandy. And like I said, we only have a couple minutes left. So I also want to talk about, what are you doing now?
Well, I retired from the riding part. Geez, I think it's about 17 years now. And when I first retired, I went to Woodbine, asked them if they had a position for me. And right away, they sent me up to the media department. I worked for a gentleman by the name of Glenn Crowder, and we were together. And he was a great guy for Woodbine Racetrack. He was a great promoter. And we used to go and do a lot of speaking engagements and going all over Ontario to promote horse racing. And I also ended up doing some TV for Woodbine, where I'd interview jockeys and trainers. And I did that for about 15 years. And I probably did TV two or three times a week. And then I saw a lot of groups that come to Woodbine, which I still do now. I'm part-time with Woodbine now. And I see a lot of fundraising groups that come and kind of mix and mingle. And these are groups that I've seen over the 15 years since I've been retired, and just enjoyed it 110%. And Woodbine Entertainment has treated me fantastic.
So you're still involved in the sport, Sandy. We're all out of time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Christina, it's been my pleasure. Anytime.
Folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website, horseracingradio.net, and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Now be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.